Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Shockwaves. Former Fox News host Gretchen Carlson is suing Fox News boss Roger Ailes for sexual harassment. Her lawyers call Ailes the Bill Cosby of media. He says the suit is retaliatory and false. More women are coming forward alleging similar experiences with the most powerful man in cable news. This hour on Point, Gretchen Carlson versus Roger Ailes and sexual harassment at work today. You can join us on air or online. Is Gretchen Carlson telling your story? Do you believe her? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from New York City is Gabriel Sherman, National Affairs Editor at New York Magazine. He's also author of The Loudest Voice in the Room, an unauthorized biography of Fox News CEO Roger Ailes. Gabe, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So give us the specifics of this lawsuit. What are the allegations made by the former Fox News anchor against Roger Ailes?
Well, Gretchen Carlson is alleging in New Jersey Superior Court that she endured sexual harassment by Roger Ailes during her 10-plus years at the network. Her lawyers allege that he propositioned her, that he told her that if they had had sex years ago, maybe her career would have turned out better, that she was harassed by her co-host Steve Doocy on the show and was shushed and basically made to play the subservient woman on the show and not a strong woman. And so these are the allegations that have surfaced in the court papers, and it's really shocking because she is the most high-profile Fox News host to publicly challenge Roger Ailes, who is famously ruthless in combating his enemies.
Here's a 2013 interview on Brian Kilmeade's radio program. Gretchen Carlson let it slip that during her time as an anchor on Fox and Friends, she was not allowed to wear pants.
Gretchen Carlson's in, dressed casual,
they
kind
don't, wait
of,
a minute.
Very nice.
Nobody's going to recognize me because not only am I dressed casually, I have on pants.
Well,
okay?
Pants.
Now, what pants, we're not allowed on Fox and Friends, remember?
Yeah, what happened with that?
So I have jeans on, Brian. Welcome to the new Gretchen.
Wow, look at that.
And here's another exchange between Brian Kilmeade and Gretchen Carlson on Fox and Friends as well.
Right, would you like to correct yourself on that other talking point about men being dominant?
Oh, we don't have any time. I wish I did. We're running over.
Okay, because HR's on the phone because you called me a skirt.
Yeah, that's. I apologize.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah.
Okay. I got to read that manual again.
I'll bring it to your office right after the show. Yeah.
Gabe Sherman, also suggesting here sort of a culture of harassment. I mean, this lawsuit is not suing Fox News, right? This is a personal lawsuit against Roger Ailes. Talk about the difference there.
Yes, that's a fascinating legal tactic that Gretchen Carlson and her lawyers have pursued. Essentially, what they're trying to do is to drive a wedge between Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch, the media mogul who controls the parent company, 21st Century Fox. Because by suing Roger Ailes, she's not trying to make this a corporate matter. She's trying to go after him personally and force Rupert Murdoch to choose, does he seek to protect Roger Ailes personally or look out for the interests of Fox News, the news network that Roger Ailes runs? Mm.
Your piece over the weekend, New York Magazine, had the stories of six women, other women, who've also come forward alleging that Roger Ailes sexually harassed them. Four of those women would not give their names. Talk about that. Do you find them credible?
Very much so. You know, sadly, Jane, I'm not surprised, as much attention as the Gretchen Carlson lawsuit is getting this week, I'm not surprised at all by it, because in my biography of Roger Ailes, which was published by Random House in 2014, I documented multiple instances of sexual harassment through the years by Roger Ailes. I quoted women by name, one of whom, Randy Harrison, was a producer in the 1980s at NBC, who told me publicly by name that Roger Ailes offered her a $100 a week raise in exchange for sex whenever he wanted. And when she cried and ran out of the office, Roger Ailes sent a friend of his to try to cover it up. And so basically this is a pattern that I am very familiar with as a journalist and an author who's covered his life and career. But it's interesting to see these allegations getting much wider public attention. And all of the women I interviewed, I've interviewed them at length, and I found their stories to be very credible because every detail was so specific. It was both specific and unique. So all the stories were different, but they all shared a pattern in that Roger Ailes, in his position as a television producer, was in a position of power over these women and could coerce them into uncomfortable sexual situations. And so I found their stories all to be very credible. Their details lined up with all of the reporting I did from my biography. Their life, wherever they were at the time in the 1960s, lined up exactly where Roger Ailes was working and living at the time. So there were no inconsistencies that I could detect, and I found them to be very brave and powerful stories.
So we have these allegations in the past that you talk about from your interviewing for the biography of Roger Ailes. We have these new multiple allegations now. What's different this time? Do you think this case will actually go to trial?
Well, I'm not a lawyer. That's a legal question. You know, legal experts are divided on that issue because what Fox News is contending, or I should say Roger Ailes, his lawyers are contending, is that Gretchen Carlson is violating her employment contract with Fox News because there's an arbitration provision in the contract which stipulates that all workplace disputes need to be worked out through private arbitration, really to keep a lot of these kinds of things out of the press. Now, Gretchen Carlson is saying that she's entitled to her day in court. She's filed in New Jersey Superior Court. And my understanding of the law, again, I'm not a lawyer, but my reading of the law is that New Jersey and New York State both have very favorable legal precedent to favor plaintiffs to get out of arbitration clauses. Now, again, the courts will decide, and Roger Ailes has filed a motion in federal court saying that no, her employment contract stipulates that she has to handle this through arbitration. And we will find out on August 1st, I believe there is a hearing when the judge is going to hear oral arguments on this case. So it's really a hotly debated issue about whether this will actually go to trial.
So Roger Ailes has responded to this suit with a statement calling the allegations false, that Carlson's suit is in retaliation for Fox's decision to not renew her contract. I just want to hear him. Here he is, Roger Ailes, back in 2010 on the Hoover Institution's webcast Uncommon Knowledge, saying what he did for television news was simply to see, long before most others did, that news was going to become entertainment.
I had a sense of what was going to happen in television, that there would be a mixture of entertainment, information, politics. It's all one now. And if they looked at Jack Parr, they wanted their politicians to be as comfortable as he was telling a story. And Jack Kennedy, of course, changed everything because he was so handsome and articulate. And so I think that the times changed. I was there.
So, Gabe Sherman, I mean, here we have Roger Ailes, powerful guy. He is Fox News, founder, CEO. You've been covering him and the network for many years. What's the strategy for him? How do you think he's able to handle this in the weeks to come?
Well, if history is a guide, his tried and true strategy is to go on the attack. You know, Roger Ailes is a ruthless political infighter. He has weathered many crises, including a former employee, Judith Regan, alleging in court documents that he told her to lie to the FBI in an obstruction of justice allegation. So these are kind of, he's no stranger to possibly career-ending scandals, and he's weathered them by going on the counterattack. So if my sense of what's going to happen is that you already see it, he's putting women forward to discredit Gretchen Carlson. He has many of his Fox News anchors that I understand to be kind of pressured to go public and say, oh, he's all above board. I have nothing but great admiration and respect for Roger Ailes. We're going to see a counter public relations campaign from him to try to muddy the waters and basically make this a he said, she said situation, which will buy him time for his lawyers to try to get this out of the courts and into arbitration. That is my sense of where this is going. Now, I should say real quickly, yep. I should say that his boss, Rupert Murdoch, the media mogul who controls the parent company of Fox News, is taking this very, very seriously. He has hired the corporate law firm Paul Weiss to do an internal investigation that is really trying to understand whether there's merit to Gretchen Carlson's allegations and also the allegations that there's pervasive culture of sexual harassment at Fox News. And so that is a parallel investigation that is going on that has nothing to do with Gretchen Carlson's lawsuit. And the outcome of that internal corporate investigation, if they find that this is a repeated pattern of behavior inside Fox News, there is, again, a very strong case to be made that Roger Ailes would be asked to step down.
You mentioned some of the other women who have come out in support of Roger Ailes, Fox News hosts and former host Jeanine Pirro, Greta Van Susteren, Maria Bartiromo. Here's Megyn Kelly, probably the most high-profile anchor, and though she's not said anything about Roger Ailes, she's talked about how he has offered her advice throughout her career. Here's an interview last year with Charlie Rose.
He's absolutely a mentor to me. He's also a friend. He is my boss. I mean, we're not equals, but I depend on him for friendship and sane, honest advice, and he'll give it to me.
You talked about the possibly career-ending scandals, you know, that we have here. I recall there was a sexual harassment lawsuit against Bill O'Reilly, which some thought would bring him down, but did not.
Yes, you know, there's some symmetry there, although I think what is different is a couple of things. Andrea Macris, the producer who filed the sexual harassment suit against O'Reilly back in 2004, she had been negotiating with Fox News prior to filing the lawsuit, which had given Fox time to prepare their counter-assault on her credibility. What's different is that Gretchen Carlson's lawyers did not tell Fox that they were filing this suit, and it caught the network and Roger Ailes completely off guard, and Gretchen Carlson was able to really establish her narrative over the first several days of this scandal. And so since then, Ailes has been furiously trying to put out a counter story that he is a good boss when it comes to women and he respects them and treats them appropriately. Now, I think the difference is now Ailes is playing defense and not offense, and so that could, again, impact the outcome.
Looking at a wedge here between Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch's sons, who are sort of moving in, jockeying for position of this major empire?
Again, yes, that's a critical difference between the Bill O'Reilly scandal and today. There is a power shift happening, and Rupert Murdoch's sons have had their personal clashes with Roger Ailes, and politically they're not as stridently conservative as their father. So there could, again, be conditions that would lead to Ailes' ouster that we probably wouldn't see, you know, 5 or 10 years ago.
That's Gabe Sherman, National Affairs Editor at New York Magazine. Gabe, thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashberg. We're talking about sexual harassment in America's workplaces as Gretchen Carlson sues Fox News CEO Roger Ailes, her former boss. You can join the conversation. What is sexual harassment to you? Have you experienced it? Been accused of it? Does your workplace's culture feed into sexual harassment? Here's a montage of Gretchen Carlson's Fox and Friends co-hosts, Brian Kilmeade and Steve Doocy, making comments about her appearance. These clips are compiled by Bloomberg Politics.
You know, I was at Lorraine last night, and some guy came up to me and said, I saw you on Fox and Friends this morning. Is Gretchen as cute in person as she is on TV?
And what did you answer, America?
Gorgeous. Look at her today. Beautiful dress. You look wonderful. Gretchen,
how are you?
You look wonderful. Gretchen, very, very beautiful dress. That's a great color. Right? In summary, Gretchen's beautiful.
Beautiful. You look beautiful.
Well,
thank you.
Look fabulous, too.
And on Twitter yesterday, Gretchen Carlson putting out a video thanking her supporters.
Thank you so much for all the support you've given me over the last few days. I've been truly blessed to have so many supporters. And, of course, blessed to have my family and all of my friends. So I just want to say thank you so much.
Let's get a broader perspective here. Joining me from Washington now is Emily Martin, Vice President of Workplace Justice for the National Women's Law Center. She looks at sexual harassment in the workplace. Emily Martin, welcome to On Point. So great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
And from Irvine, California, Catherine Fisk is with us, Professor of Labor and Employment Law at the University of California, Irvine. Professor Fisk, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
Emily, let's start with you. Broaden this out for us. What sort of dynamics do you see at play in this lawsuit against Roger Ailes, broadly speaking?
Well, broadly speaking, what we see here is someone challenging someone really important in her company, her most important boss, which obviously is a thing that's very difficult to do. And we know that most women who experience sexual harassment don't bring a complaint, don't make a formal charge, precisely because the stakes are really high when you're saying that the superstar in my organization has sexually harassed me.
Catherine Fisk, Professor Fisk, what's the legal definition of sexual harassment? Because it's not a criminal offense, right, unless it involves a crime like rape or assault. What's the legal definition?
The legal definition of harassment is unwelcome conduct that renders the workplace hostile to a reasonable person, which means it has to be sufficiently severe or pervasive to effectively alter the conditions of the person's employment.
So isn't it true, though, that there are different perceptions about what that can be? What's appropriate to one person may be offensive to another. You know, laughing about one thing, sexual harassment, on the other hand, joking around. I mean, the line can get so blurred, can it not?
Not really. And the reason is because the harassment has to be sufficiently severe or pervasive to render the workplace hostile to a reasonable person. The idle comment about somebody's looks is not sufficiently severe or pervasive, but touching, constant belittling, constant comments about somebody's appearance or sex, people know what harassment is when they see it happening or when it happens to them.
Emily Martin, what puts a workplace at greater risk for sexual harassment to occur?
Well, when there are big power disparities in a workplace, and particularly when men are the ones who have more power on the job and women are working in lower power, lower wage roles, that definitely is a risk factor. And overall, in our economy, women are the majority of workers in low-wage jobs, which is probably one reason why harassment is still so widespread. At least one in four women experience sexual harassment, and some surveys put that as a clear majority, 60 to 75% of women who've experienced sexual harassment in the job at some point.
Emily, the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, formed a task force to study workplace harassment within the last couple of years. Are there reliable statistics on how many people are harassed, sexually harassed at work?
Well, again, different studies come to different conclusions, but a low-end estimate is one in four women experience sexual harassment on the job at some point. And in some industries, that number is way higher. So, for example, in construction, a very male-dominated field where only about 3% of workers are women, surveys show that 88% of women working in construction have experienced sexual harassment. So there are definitely industries that are male-dominated, where women are seen as intruders or interlopers, where the risk of harassment is exceptionally high. But in the workplaces overall, it is still very much a real problem.
It's not just women, though, who suffer sexual harassment. I mean, generally speaking, but men as well, Emily.
That's true. Women are the majority of people who report and experience sexual harassment, but men experience it as well. And, you know, sexual harassment can look like a lot of different things. It can be a sexual proposition that sleep with me or I'll fire you or I won't give you the promotion. It can also be sort of gender-based hostility. So, for example, one way you can see sexual harassment is if a man isn't typically masculine, if he has some traits which his coworkers think are too feminine. Being bullied because he's not conforming to gender stereotypes. That's a kind of sexual harassment, too.
Lot of calls here. Let's get one in here first. In Iowa City, Iowa, Marcia is on the air. Glad you called, Marcia. Welcome.
Hello, Jane Clayton. I always enjoy it when you host the program.
Thank you very much.
Why not believe this woman? When you give the lead into the story, one of the questions is, why not believe her? Well, why not believe the other people, the other women that have come forward now? Roger Ailes continues the pattern of harassment and intimidation that women find in any workplace. It's pervasive. She didn't tell him prior to filing the suit. So what? She told him no, rejected his advances many times. Why would she tell him? What's the difference? And it's just, it reminds me of the white-black racist division that people promote. That is to say, in my community, when you poll people, black people say, yes, there is racial discrimination. And white people say, no, there's not. I would suggest that the people that are being discriminated against have the best insight to what's happening.
Marcia, thank you. I appreciate your call there from Iowa. Let's get Carl in here from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Carl. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. You know, if the Bill Cosby thing taught us anything, is that we can't constantly take the rich and powerful males' side in these type of situations over his female subordinates. And on a me personally, I'm conflicted. I have a wife. Mm-hmm. I have three daughters, and I'm conflicted with my support of her because with Gretchen, because I believe personally that Fox News has been one of the most poisonous things in American society for the past 25 years. And she has been right there at the center of this. So I'm conflicted as a husband and as a father to support someone that I believe that has immeasurably damaged the core of America and has been a part of that. But at the same time, I must support a woman that claims this, because this is a very serious claim.
Someone that speaks up. Yeah, no, I hear you, Carl. I'm glad you called. Let's get back to our experts here. Professor Fisk, talk about Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prevents discrimination based on race, based on gender, based on religion and nationality. It generally applies to companies that employ 15 people or more. What if your company has fewer than 15 people and you're sort of stuck in this setting?
If you work for a company with fewer than 15 people, depending on the state or the city where you work, you might have a claim under state or sometimes even local law. For example, the lawsuit against Roger Ailes is filed in New Jersey Superior Court under the New Jersey Law Against Discrimination, which defines employer differently than Title VII. In California, for example, you can bring a harassment claim under the state Fair Employment Law against an employer with five or more employees. Moreover, even if you aren't able to sue under a state anti-discrimination law, depending on the nature of the harassment, you might have a tort claim. If your boss grabs you, that's a battery. If he makes you afraid that he's going to hurt you, that's an assault. If it's a constant pattern of belittling or intimidation such that you suffer emotional distress, that's intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Well, we first...
All of those claims can be brought regardless.
Yes, now I hear you. It's an important distinction. I mean, 25 years ago, it was Anita Hill, right, who brought sexual harassment really into the national spotlight with her claims against then-Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. Here she is from the opening statement in October 1991 during the reopened confirmation hearings for now Justice Clarence Thomas. She claimed that she had been sexually harassed by him.
It would have been more comfortable to remain silent. I took no initiative to inform anyone. But when I was asked by a representative of this committee to report my experience, I felt that I had to tell the truth. I could not keep silent.
And here is then Senator Joe Biden questioning Anita Hill at that confirmation hearing. He asked her what incidents actually occurred in Thomas's office.
The incident about the Coke can occurred in his office at the EEOC.
And what was that incident again?
The incident involved his going to his desk, getting up from a work table, going to his desk, looking at this can and saying, "Who put pubic hair on my Coke?"
Emily Martin, do you think our understanding of what constitutes sexual harassment has changed since that time? And practically speaking, did laws change?
Since Anita Hill's testimony in 1991, I think there's a lot more popular understanding that sexual harassment in the workplace is unacceptable. I think that people understand better what sexual harassment looks like and that it's not just an interpersonal problem you have at work, that it's a legal problem and that it's an abuse. And I think so. I think Anita Hill's testimony was incredibly important for broadening that understanding. Mm-hmm. And laws have changed. After Anita Hill testified, Congress passed and George H.W. Bush signed the 1991 Civil Rights Act, which strengthened protections against discrimination, including harassment. And frankly, passage of that law was directly connected to Anita Hill's testimony and to the backlash when people across the country saw this all-male panel of senators grilling this mm-hmm. woman and mm-hmm. casting aspersions on her stories. And Congress felt a need to show that they actually were taking this seriously and cared about discrimination in the workplace.
Let's go to Jim in Akron, Ohio. Hi, Jim. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hey, I just want to say that, you know, I agree with the journalist. I agree that something happened to her, you know, and for what reason would she say that it did, you know? I mean, there is no reason why she's just going to, you know, put herself up there to be crucified if it didn't. And I've had something happen to me, you know, and it's mixed feelings. I'm a man, and I was sexually harassed at work really bad by my boss. And I ended up quitting, you know, and we have mainly men that work there and a very small amount of people, probably 13 people work there. And I had just, it was just a weird feeling, you know. Some men would think, hey, you know, she's beautiful, whatever, whatever. I'm a married man, and I was not, you know, it just took me off guard. And I definitely felt very belittled. I felt less than. I did not like it whatsoever, and I ended up just quitting that job. Mm.
Jim, thank you. It brings us to a good point, Professor Fisk. Do victims of sexual harassment who sue, do they typically lose their jobs? Do they quit, even if they win, even if there's a settlement? What typically happens?
Victims of sexual harassment often find that they are retaliated against for complaining about the harassment. And what happens at that point depends. Sometimes they will stay in the job and continue to use the internal to the company complaint procedures to try to protect themselves. Sometimes they will conclude that the stress of being in a harassing situation is so enormous, their own mental health will be better protected by leaving the job and trying to find another position. It really depends on what the company response or the harasser's response is to the claims of harassment.
Emily Martin, what do you see as the typical response in companies to sexual harassment?
Well, there's a big range. There are definitely companies that take anti-harassment policies seriously, that have a culture from the top of making clear that that sort of behavior is not acceptable in the workplace, and that have accountability measures in place to ensure that when a complaint of harassment is brought forward, that it is dealt with promptly, and if it is substantiated, that a harasser is disciplined or terminated appropriately. Unfortunately, there are other workplaces where the culture is very different. And there are definitely situations where, as Professor Fisk says, women and men who bring harassment complaints are at real risk of retaliation. And that retaliation can take a lot of different forms, from formal actions like termination to informal further harassment that just makes work intolerable. In some instances, again, in more dangerous jobs like, say, policing or firefighting, if your coworkers or supervisors are retaliating against you, it can have lethal consequences because you're actually being put in danger by the lack of support that you're getting in the workplace. So there is a large range of responses. And while retaliation based on a complaint of sexual harassment is very clearly illegal, it still definitely does happen.
From what we know, Emily, how often does a sexual harassment case go to court? How often is it settled? How often does it go to court?
Well, again, very few sexual harassment issues get to a formal complaint in the first place. As many as 90% of sexual harassment, as much as 90% of sexual harassment goes unreported. Mm. When someone does bring a charge, often this will be resolved through some sort of settlement before getting to trial, which actually can be the best result for all involved. Mm-hmm. But going to court, there's definitely plenty of legal hurdles in any plaintiff's path in an employment discrimination case.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the ongoing problem of sexual harassment at the workplace and the big new conversation that's going on after former Fox News host Gretchen Carlson filed a suit against Fox CEO Roger Ailes. You can join the conversation. Did you file charges? Tell HR. What happened to you? Did they believe you? Were you ever accused of it? Being a woman in the workplace was very different years ago from the series premiere of Mad Men, which takes place in 1960. Pete Campbell, played by Vincent Kartheiser, meets Secretary Peggy Olson, played by Elizabeth Moss, for the first time.
Are you Amish or something?
No, I'm from Brooklyn.
Well, you're in the city now. Wouldn't be a sin for us to see your legs. If you pull your waist in a little bit, you might look like a woman.
Is that all, Mr. Draper?
Hey, I'm not done here. I'm working my way up.
And here's Brian Kilmeade and Steve Doocy on Fox and Friends addressing Fox contributor Laura Ingraham. Gretchen Carlson is sitting next to them on the couch she hosts.
Do you like a woman masseuse or a male masseuse? Just so I know.
Oh, my God.
Not on TV.
I'm not going to.
You don't have to.
I'm not.
You
know what? Now, Laura, now you know what I go through.
Emily Martin is with us this hour, Vice President of Workplace Justice for the National Women's Law Center. Catherine Fisk is with us as well, Professor of Employment Law at the University of California, Irvine. Emily and Catherine, stand by. I want to bring another voice in now. Joining me from New York is Maureen Sherry, former Managing Director at Bear Stearns, a global investment bank. Spent a lot of time in the financial industry. She wrote a novel based on her years on Wall Street called Opening Bell. Maureen Sherry, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So your book puts a spotlight on the way women have been treated in the financial industry. You yourself spent more than a decade on Wall Street. When did you start to realize there was something wrong or toxic about the particular environment you were in on Wall Street?
You know, Jane, when I began, I was right out of college. And even though there was some pretty outrageous behavior, there was that naive part of myself that thought, oh, this is how it is in the working world. And you really saw that bro culture, that if you chose not to go along with it, you felt quite ostracized. And so, you know, I would feel that kind of the ambitious women sort of looked the other way and put up with it. And one thing you're asking how I noticed a change, the change was that as the years went by and I became more senior and started to recruit women, discussions about that were asked of me during interviews, and the amount of women who would come and leave seemed to increase.
What did you say to those women in those interviews?
Initially, I, again, want to stress, I'm not proud of my behavior. Definitely the team player. Talked about you have to have kind of a thick skin here because we are outnumbered, you know, by 90%, male versus female. But that if you can, it's a really terrific job. It's so interesting. It's, you're going to love it if you can put up with this stuff. And that I talked a lot about this is almost a fraternal behavior, that it's not meant to make you cry or upset, but that it's more something about the culture of Wall Street or on a trading floor specifically.
In the novel that you've written, Opening Bell, the protagonist, Bell, who's a managing director at a major New York City trading desk, and her female co-workers form what's called the Glass Ceiling Club. Yeah. They get together to talk about the sexism that they're encountering at work. You talked about the interviews where these young women come in and sort of ask you about it. Did women generally feel that they could be open with each other, talk about harassment, talk about sexism?
No, I would say definitely not, and quite the opposite. You know, I felt, again, you wanted to be accepted. You wanted to be seen as being very serious about and not distracted or complaining about things like that. My specific experience was, as the years went by, I did find a group of other women who were relatively senior, and we as a joke, we did call ourselves the Glass Ceiling Club, and we did not want to see the same class action lawsuits that many of our competing banks were having filed against them. So we went to very senior management and tried to talk about changing the culture of our firm.
And did it work?
No, it did not work.
Well, right. And I'll quote here from a New York Times op-ed piece that you wrote. You talk about a male coworker drinking a shot of your breast milk on a dare. Talk about some of the other examples of this flagrant harassment.
Yeah. So there was a lot of things like that, mostly like jokes. And it wasn't, again, it was to make the other men laugh. And what was so kind of upsetting was you would hire these, you know, new younger men would come in and they would take their cues and learn their lessons from the more senior men. And so I think I heard your discussion earlier on the Ailes case, and, you know, here you have this person of great power, and if his behavior is a certain way, that's modeled for the younger men as being appropriate. There was a wonderful op-ed last week by a man named Sam Polk about the bro culture of Wall Street and how if you don't ascribe to that behavior, you feel like you're on the outs. That if you want to be a successful man in certain businesses, you have to kind of go along with the, you know, that kind of talk and that kind of behavior.
What sort of advice, lastly here, Maureen Sherry, would you give a young woman entering the industry right now?
You know, I'm a firm believer that arbitration should go, and I was upset to read that the Ailes case is also, you know, trying to enforce arbitration. I think that the more transparent it is, the better it will be for women and for men. So I would encourage women, actually, if they like the financial industry, to join the financial industry, to work there, because I think it's a numbers thing. I think once the numbers become more equal, that hopefully a lot of this behavior will go away.
Maureen Sherry, a former managing director at Bear Stearns, wrote a novel based on her 11 years on Wall Street called Opening Bell. Maureen, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Thank you. Professor Fisk, Maureen mentions arbitration. Roger Ailes' legal team is trying to push this lawsuit against him to arbitration. Talk about that. What is it? And does arbitration benefit the employee or the company generally?
Many employers require employees to agree as a condition of employment that they will arbitrate all legal claims arising out of the employment. And so employees don't have the option that statutes give them of going to court, but instead have to go to an arbitration forum. The difficulty with arbitration is that arbitration agreements typically require that everybody keep what happens completely confidential, which means that nobody will ever find out what happened, what the allegations were. So therefore, other employees can't be warned about the problems in the workplace. And also, arbitrators often are less inclined than judges and juries to award serious damages to compensate people for the harms they suffer. Mm.
The EEOC actually just issued a general policy statement last week that blasted mandatory arbitration clauses for these kinds of cases. Let's get back to the phones, get our listeners in here. Liz in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Liz. Glad you waited. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to share my story.
Okay.
And it occurs to me as I listen to your program that I was propositioned. I worked in probably the most popular bar in Detroit in the mid-1980s. I was a single mom. And the boss's brothers shared some local celebrity, and one of them, his wife, also worked there. You know, it's a bar, and I was young, and you just kind of accepted sexual comments in that era and that setting. But one evening, he cornered me in the storage room and offered to be my sugar daddy and spelled out what he would do for me and what I should do for him to get that.
And what'd you do?
And I finished my shift, I just said, I'm not a weak person either. I just said, I'll think about it because I wasn't sure how to handle it. I had two children at home and needed the pay.
Right.
That night I got home. I never went back. I never collected my final paycheck. I never used it as a recommendation on further applications. I'd worked there for a few years, so I had a few year wait work gap
yeah.
in my resume whenever I would apply elsewhere. That cost me a lot and my children a lot in that era. And as your experts were discussing the impact of Anita Hill, one of the things, I've always been a fighter for the underdog. It's always harder to fight for myself than others. But I can remember 7 years later in the Anita Hill
hearings.
Drama.
Yeah.
I can just remember thinking, if I would have known that, if I would have known, if I would have thought there was something that I could have done, I would.
You would have. Liz, I'm so glad you called, and I appreciate you telling your story very much. Let's get Donna in here from Hartfield, Ohio. Hi, Donna. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
I just wanted to... I'm experiencing so much identification with the other callers right now. And my story is that when I graduated from college in 1989, I'm 48 right mm-hmm. now. And when I graduated, I really looked at, you know, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, as something that, you know, when you're young, 20 years seems like a long time. And I looked at that as something that was really, you know, part of our history in America rather than something that I would experience. But when I went to an interview for my first job and I didn't get it right away, and later I found out that a man was hired instead, and then that man took another job, the superintendent called me back and he said point blank to me on the phone, we've had a lot of instability in our English department and we really want to hire you, but we know that you're getting married in December and we just need to know, you know, we need to ask this question. Normally we wouldn't ask it, but you know, are you planning on having children anytime soon? Mm. And that was in 1989, and I was shocked. Mm. But I was also 22 years old, 21. I started teaching the day after I turned 22. And I didn't have any resources. I didn't, you know, I couldn't say to him, you know, yes, I am, or no, I'm not.
And none of your business, right, Donna? I hear it. It's an important part of this as well, and I'm glad you called. It makes me think about Emily Martin. You know, Donna's story, Liz's story, 20 years ago. What the trend is now in our more sort of casual workplaces with office environments that are a little more laid back, you know, where the boundaries between a manager and employee are a little more blurred. You're friends with your boss on Facebook. You text your coworkers after hours. Does it make it harder to identify and stop sexual harassment? Is there more confusion about what is off limits, Emily?
Well, it is true that with social media, for example, that there may be some blurring between work time and work relationships and non-work time and non-work relationships in a way that can be complicated. That being said, I feel as though that really it's been that we've made a lot of progress as a country in identifying what's okay and what's not okay, which doesn't mean that there's not still work to do. But, you know, you had the Mad Men clip. I think we've come a long way in making clear that there are certain things which we don't do in the workplace because they are abusive and because they are belittling and because they box women out of economic opportunities and employment opportunities.
I want to get Josie in here. We're running out of time in Boston. Josie, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks.
Hi. Yes.
I just had a question about whether or not something is sexual harassment.
Okay.
So I work in retail, and I've had a coworker, ask me very personal questions, like about stuff that like you shouldn't be talking about at work,
mm-hmm.
like sex life, that kind of thing. And this person has also kind of made me feel uncomfortable for being gay, which I don't think is legal, really, like to be discriminated against for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I have.
Josie, thank you. Professor Fisk, what do you tell Josie, and what do you tell people who are being harassed at work? What do you do?
If you think you're being harassed at work, and for example, with Josie's coworker, if she has asked him to stop or suggested that it's not proper to discuss that kind of stuff at work, it's none of his business, and it persists, the thing to do is to complain to the person in the organization whose job it is to take complaints about harassment.
So does that mean go to HR, you go to human resources?
It means typically to go to human resources. Every workplace has to create a process that allows employees to complain about harassment. And if the harasser is your supervisor, it's unlawful for a company to have a harassment policy that requires that you complain to the supervisor who's harassing you. But the point is, go to some supervisor, explain what's happening. The company then is legally required to take prompt and effective remedial action. And so somebody should then speak to the coworker to say, you've been asking questions mm-hmm. that make your colleague feel mm-hmm. uncomfortable. And if the company fails to do that, the company will be liable for the harassment. Mm. But if the worker doesn't complain and later wants to sue, the company will have a defense to liability, saying, look, we didn't know that there was a problem. If we'd known, we would have stopped it.
It's much harder.
Fixed it.
I would just add that one important thing in Josie's question, the EEOC has recently taken the position that discrimination based on sexual orientation is a form of illegal sex discrimination, which means harassment based on sexual orientation is a form of illegal sexual harassment. So there are definitely some protections out there.
Most companies have some form of training regarding sexual harassment. In our last 15 seconds here, Emily Martin, what do you say? What do we need to do to get us to a better place on this?
Well, definitely training regarding the anti-harassment policies and procedures that every company should have in place, and real commitment and recognition from the top that there are costs of harassment in terms of decreased productivity and reputational damage and liability, and it's in businesses' best interest to ensure it doesn't happen on their watch.
Emily Martin, Vice President of Workplace Justice for National Women's Law Center. Emily, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Catherine Fisk, Professor of Labor and Employment Law at the University of California, Irvine. Great to have you, Professor. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Continue our conversation online. Get the podcast. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.